We're studying the 7th chapter of the book of Daniel. We'd gotten down to verse 8, but that's a little misleading because in verse 8 we found an entity that is described throughout most of the rest of the chapter. You'll remember that we talked about the lion that Daniel saw in this vision that he was having, and that represented the Babylonian Empire. The bear represented the Medo-Persian Empire. The leopard represented the Macedonian Empire. Finally, the diverse beast that wasn't like anything Daniel could see in the zoo was descriptive of the Roman Empire. And then out of that Roman Empire, there grew a little horn. And I have postulated to you that that little horn represents in symbolic language the papal dynasty. And we were talking about the predictions that were made about that little horn throughout the rest of the chapter when we had to conclude. I was showing you some statements made by the popes themselves that actually show a fulfillment, I believe, of some of the things that are mentioned regarding the papal dynasty. For instance, he shall think to change times and laws in verse 25. We've looked at a statement, and this was the last slide I showed you, I believe, a statement by Pope Nicholas from the 15th century, no marvel if it be in my power to change times and laws, to alter and abrogate laws, to dispense with all things, yea, with the precepts of Christ. And this has been the attitude through the years. Amazing as it seems, I mean, it's hard to understand how people get to that place where they would even say something like that. But that's what we were talking about last time, and I talked right up till 8 o'clock or maybe a little after and didn't give you a chance. Anybody have a question or comment over anything we've talked about in our previous two sessions? Yeah, Ed, go ahead.
The significance of it being a little horn, yeah. I think, you know, like you mentioned here, you can't imagine why a man would say things like that. So there are very little men boasting great things. And, yeah. You know, I heard a salesman say one time, the bigger the lie, the more they buy. Yeah. And, you know, I just think it's things like that. The only remedy is know the Word of God.
Exactly right. Yes, not only is it true that the bigger the lie, the more they buy, but also repeat the lie as often as possible and get people used to hearing it. Absolutely true. I appreciate that very much. Anything else that anybody had? I want you to speak up if and when you have something. Don't just make up something to say. I'm definitely not audience dependent as far as needing to have you fill in for me because I've got lots of things to say too. But I want us to stay together as a class if we possibly can. And the only way to do that, I feel like, is for you to add. There's no stupid question. If you don't know what we're doing with this symbolism at all, don't hesitate to say so, and we'll try to stay together as a class. If nobody has anything further to say right now, we'll just go on. I mentioned to you, I think, that the Roman papacy speaks clearly as Antichrist. There are several terms in the New Testament, and I believe that's what the New Testament term Antichrist is talking about. They supposedly derive their authority from being the supposed successor of the Apostle Peter. And an Antichrist is a counter Christ or a substitute Christ, a vice Christ. In other words, it's one who takes the place of Christ. We find this expression used by the Apostle John, 1 John chapter 2, verse 18 and verse 22, 1 John 4, verse 3, and 2 John, verse 7. This expression was apparently well known in the early church because the Apostle John said, "You have heard that Antichrist is coming." So this was apparently something that had been discussed quite a bit, and maybe other apostles had taught about it too. The expression from the Greek language can mean one who stands in opposition to Christ or one who puts himself in the place of Christ. And of course, it can mean both, but there is an ostensible understanding here that the Pope puts himself in the place of Christ. He's like another Christ. He's setting himself up as the counterpart of the true Christ. And this is evident in so many things that he says. The expression antichrist is similar to the word antitype, which I think you're familiar with. There are types in the Old Testament, and in the New Testament we have the fulfillment in the antitype. For instance, in the Old Testament we have a lot about the tabernacle, and then in the New Testament, the writer of the Hebrew letter tells us in chapter 8 that the church is the true tabernacle which the Lord pitched and not man. So the tabernacle was the type, and then the New Testament tells us that the church is the antitype, the fulfillment of it. We have the story of Isaac in the Old Testament. Isaac is a type of Christ. And then we have Christ, the fulfillment of that type in the New Testament. So this is a concept that I think we're pretty much all familiar with. Antitype denotes a relationship of correspondence between the symbol and the thing that is symbolized. So antichrist denotes not per se a person who rejects the person or teaching of Christ, but rather one who as a rival usurps the office and the prerogatives of Christ. We found in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 that he sits in the temple of God proclaiming himself that he is God. And that I think is talking about the same entity that we see here in chapter 7 verse 8 about this little horn. He starts out in his incipiency and he's a very small power, but he accumulates political power over time. Pretty soon he's being sent out to have political and military discussions with some of the barbarians that were threatening the city of Rome. The bishop of Rome was sent out there to do that negotiating. So he's just accumulating that over time, long before he was regarded as the universal father, long before he was regarded as the Lord of all the churches, it took centuries to accumulate this power. And the expression here at the end of verse 8 that he had eyes like the eyes of man, I think indicates, it hints at a personal force more than just a political abstraction. He's the head of the great apostasy predicted by Paul in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. He's the little horn having eyes like the eyes of a man and a mouth speaking great things. A pseudo-apostolical antichrist who sets Christ aside while in mouth confessing him and professing himself to be in the place of Christ, to be the power of God. We have the word anti-pope also, which is used in much the same way. One who claims to be the pope, but who really is a rival usurper of the one who is actually regarded as a pope. So he's called an anti-pope. And by the way, that little book I showed you last week, the Oxford Dictionary of Popes, has a long list, not only of the popes, but also of the anti-popes. So if you're going to be studying this type of thing in the future, there's a lot of value, I think, in this little book. You're welcome to borrow mine anytime you want to, but it just gives a little biography of all these people, and it even tells you about Pope Joan, because there was a woman involved one time. Anyway, I hope that's understandable. I think it's a little hard to explain it, but I believe that the Antichrist describes the development that we're talking about here. And it starts very early because there were many of them in the Apostle John's time, according to what he tells us. The Roman Church, under the authority of the popes, has been a vicious persecutor of those who oppose its apostate doctrines. During the Spanish Inquisition, which was a tribunal established by the Roman Church for the suppressing of error, I don't know how many people were burned alive for their alleged heresies. During the St. Bartholomew's Day massacre on August 24th, 1572, as many as 100,000 Protestants were killed near Paris by this entity. So when we look at chapter 7, verse 25, which we've had occasion already to look at several things in it, we're told there that he shall wear out the saints of the Most High. Interestingly, in 1870, in the city of Madrid in Spain, while workmen were cutting a new road, they discovered the Quemadero, which meant the burning place. Henry Grattan Guinness reports having been there, so we have an eyewitness testimony from him. The name Guinness may be familiar because it's a brewing company that's well known around the world. many of the people in this family were brewers, but there were also many people in this family who were missionaries. So there was kind of a split in the family. Michelle Guinness has written several books about the Guinness family. Anyway, this man who wrote commentaries on the book of Daniel, the book of Revelation, he said, chest high in the remains of the martyrs in a trench that had been opened for a highway construction. This wasn't intending to reveal that. It's just that when they cut this new road, suddenly here's all these ashes of all these people. I'll just read what he said. Quote, when the Quemadero was opened at Madrid in 1870 and the ashes of the martyrs who had been burned by the Inquisition brought to light, we were present and saw that thick bank of human remains and stood breast deep in the ashes. He goes on to say, we have seen in Mexico skeletons of victims of the Inquisition who had been buried alive. We have visited the Inquisition in Rome and have seen its prisons and conversed with its inquisitors. Its history, written in tears and blood, fills, next to the story of the crucifixion of Christ, the darkest page in the records of humanity. That's in his book, History Unveiling Prophecy, page 108. And bear in mind that this Madrid Quemadero is only one of 12 places in the country of Spain where heretics were regularly burned. And Spain was only one of the European countries, of course. And the Inquisition was not limited to Europe. The Inquisition was all around the globe. The Inquisition was in Japan. The Inquisition was on the ships at sea. So you could run, but it was really hard to hide. They would find you, most likely. We're told here, as we've already suggested, that the little horn will think to change times and laws in verse 25. According to Roman Catholic dogma, ecclesiastical authority and tradition carries as much weight, if not more, than the Word of God itself. It's just a fact of life that the Roman Church feels free to change or make religious laws as it sees fit. And history is replete with examples instituting those policies and changing various elements of the law of Christ. You're all familiar with the idea of the celibacy of the clergy. Where'd that come from? Didn't come from God. Clergy just means portion, and God's clergy is God's portion. That idea that men will regard you as the ministers of God and the priests of God shows that we're all joint heirs with Christ. We're all ministers of God and priests. There's no separation there into clergy versus laity. But the celibacy of the clergy has been advocated for years and still is advocated. Yeah, Phil, Sean, go ahead.
We often hear the word see in connection with the Pope. Is there any more definition to that or what they are?
Yeah,
where did that come from?
The Holy See, he's just talking about his domain. That's really all there is to it.
It's not seeing something that nobody else can see.
No. Although he is deemed to be a seer, but the see just refers to his domain. Good question. Anybody else got a question or a thought? Okay. And again, as I said last week, I'm a bit apologetic about talking so negatively about another religious organization, but I do believe the Bible is talking about it, and we need to educate one another about this so that we know. Of course, some of you have come out of this system and are already very well educated about it and could probably educate us further about it. But they changed things. The celibacy of the clergy did not come from the Bible. Man invented that. The adoration of images, the worship of the saints, transubstantiation. We could go on and on. You know what transubstantiation is? That when the priest during the Mass has gone to a certain point, that the grape juice or the wine is literally changed into the blood of Jesus Christ. The bread is literally changed into the actual body of Christ, so much so that through the years there have been so many reported cases of sticking a fork into the bread and it will bleed, and this type of thing, superstition through the years. Transubstantiation, because Jesus said, this is my body, this is my blood, and so they're taking that literally, not understanding that Jesus is speaking metaphorically.
A lot of those practices came about to attract pagans
yes.
into their
absolutely
church and so forth. I was talking to a guy about, we were talking about the first day of the week, and I asked him, what day is that? And he said, Monday.
Yeah.
And if you look at a lot of calendars,
yeah,
they start with Monday, and the weekend is Saturday and Sunday. And I think there's just subtle things like that.
I agree.
That get us to thinking differently. And I also know that during the French Revolution, they tried a 10-day calendar week.
Right. That's right. To get rid of the connection with the Bible, because there's no astronomical basis for the week. We have an astronomical basis for a day, one rotation of the earth on its axis. We have an astronomical basis for a year, one revolution of the earth around the sun. We have an astronomical basis for a month. It's a month. But there's no astronomical basis for a week. You only get that from Genesis chapter 1, and they couldn't abide that because they were throwing the baby out with the bathwater. When they got rid of Roman Catholicism, they wanted to get rid of all religion along with it because they were so sick of the abuse from the clergy primarily. So, yes, they tried to do away with the week, and that lasted for about 12 years, and then they went back to the week. Very interesting. Just very interesting. Excellent comment. Thank you. Anything else? Okay, you're doing very well. I appreciate it. It hurts our heart when our friends and in some cases relatives are involved with this system, because there are some pretty fine people that I know that are involved with this system. There was a girl I went to high school with, for example. Linda, you might remember her. I don't know if I should say because we're recording this, but she's dead now, so I'll just say her name. Laura Chappell. Did you remember her? Real sweet girl. She was a year behind us and later died of cancer. But when they printed her funeral notice, this was a few years ago when I was still seeing a newspaper once in a while, they printed with her funeral notice her last prayer to St. Jude. And I just thought that was just really sad. What a sweet girl to be caught up with that system. I mean, this was a girl that I knew pretty well. I had some classes with her. We had study sessions together at her house, and just a really nice person. And to be involved with that system all your life and so that you die in it, no wonder the Lord said, come ye out from among them and be separate and touch not the unclean thing. No wonder the 18th chapter of Revelation said, come out of her, my people, that you be not partakers of her sins, and therefore don't have to partake of her plagues. So it's just a sad situation. We want to do everything we can to let people know the truth. A lot of times they won't accept it, but we want to give them the opportunity to know the truth. This little horn speaks great swelling words. He blasphemes God. He changes times and laws. He wears out the saints of the Most High. And we're told that the saints were to be under the oppressive power of this little horn for a time and times and the dividing of time. This again is the end of verse 25. Until a time and times and the dividing of time. Here we have an expression which with its equivalents appears seven times in the Bible, twice here in the book of Daniel, and five times in the book of Revelation, but it's not sprinkled throughout the book of Revelation. It's only in that little book about the little horn. Remember in the 10th chapter of Revelation, John 8, a little book, and it turned out, he starts writing chapters 11, 12, 13, it's a little book about the little horn. And this expression is only used in those chapters. In fact, I'll just give you a list. We have it here in Daniel 7:25, time, times, and dividing of time. Daniel 12:7, time, times, and a half. Revelation 11:2, 42 months. Revelation 11:3, 1,260 days. Revelation 12:6, 1,260 days. Revelation 12:14, a time and times, and half a times. And finally, Revelation 13, verse 5, 42 months. I believe that these are all intended to be equivalent expressions, and I personally believe that they all refer to the same period in the history of time. Now, a time is a year. Back in chapter 4, when we studied it, I think I taught a class on it maybe not too long ago. We saw that Nebuchadnezzar was insane until seven times passed over him. That was 7 years. There is no larger natural period of time than 1 year. There's no cycle in nature that's so marked and so pronounced and really so obvious as a year. Right now, it's April, and we know what to expect. It's even though we have some chilly days still now, it's going to get warmer because we're in spring. So we count time by years. A time is a year, and two times is 2 years, and the dividing of times is half a year, so that's 3.5 years. 42 months is 3.5 years. 1260 days is 3.5 years with 30-day months. So these symbols in apocalyptic language are like hieroglyphics. They're little pictures to symbolize bigger things. A beast, for example, as we've seen, represents a whole empire. And a day, that's one rotation of the earth on its axis, equals a year in prophecy, one revolution of the earth around the sun. And I'm not just sucking that out of my thumb. There's a couple of Old Testament passages I want to refer to here, Numbers 14:34 and Ezekiel chapter 4, verse 6, because this is where that principle is nailed down in the Old Testament. Before we ever get to the book of Daniel, we find this here. For instance, in Numbers chapter 13 and 14, Moses sends 12 spies into the land to spy out the land. 10 of those spies come back with an evil report that we can't possibly take this land. The people are too much for us, and they're not even considering that God gave us this land and he wants us to go in and take it. And if God be for us, who can be against us? No. 10 of the 12 said, we can't possibly take this land. So the upshot of that was that God said, since you refuse to go in and take the land as I have told you, you're going to have to wander. Your generation is going to have to wander around in the wilderness until you die off, and maybe the next generation will be better than you. So you're going to have to wander in the wilderness for 40 years. Each day for a year, each day that you were in the promised land and decided you couldn't take it, because they were in there for 40 days. Each day that you were in there and saw the sights of what I'm giving you and decided you couldn't take it, you're going to have to wander a year for each day. And that's the bottom line on that is in Numbers 14:34. We have the same idea in Ezekiel chapter 4, verse 6. Ezekiel is told that you're going to make a little construction of the city, just a minor model of the city, and you're going to go out beside that. This is in public. You're going to lay on your right side for so many days, and then on your left side for so many days, because these 390 days and these 40 days all have a meaning, and I have given you a day for a year. For every day you lie on one side, that has a year in meaning in this prophecy. For every day you lie on the other side, that has a year in meaning in this prophecy. So Ezekiel 4, 3 through 6, and especially verse 6, makes that statement again. I have given you a day for a year. This is a sound biblical principle, and therefore, when we see other prophecies, like the one we're looking at now, constructed on the same principle, we should interpret their chronological periods by the same rule. Now, having said that, I'll say this just as a precursor. We'll find a notable exception to this in chapter 8, but that will be for a very good and clear reason that's right in the text itself. And I'll try to discuss that with you when we get there. But as a general rule, and there's a real reason to make a difference on that in chapter 8, when we're talking about the little horn there that comes out of the third beast, out of the third empire, not out of the fourth empire. For our purposes here in chapter 7, and in the book of Revelation as well, 1260 days means 1260 years. And notice that this is not a round number. Sometimes when you have a round number in the Bible, like 10 or 100 or 1,000 or 10,000, it's not used to convey statistical information. 10 would mean a few, and 100 would mean more than that, between 10 and 1,000. 1,000 is between 100 and 10,000. But they're not used to, the number 1,000, for instance, in Revelation 20, does not mean one more than 999 and one less than 1,001. It's just referring to a lot of something. If it's referring to cattle, the cattle on 1,000 hills are his, that doesn't mean the cattle on the 1,001st hill belong to somebody else. They're God's too. Because it's not trying to convey numerical information there. It's just saying a lot. 10,000 is a myriad, and that is a lot more than 1,000. So the idea when you have a round number is not always statistical, but when you have a number like this, 1,260, I think that that means that it's referring to 1,260 years. And remember, in trying to find out what this 1,260 years is, it must not only be future to Daniel, who's making the prophecy 600 years before Christ, but it must also be future to the Apostle John, who's going to write his prophecy 100 years after Christ, 96 A.D. So it must be future to both of them. And these are all important clues. We've talked about this before. When I gave you a chart, Brother Brumback's chart of the apostasy and the denominational world that sprang off of that. I've got some more of those, by the way, if you want them, and if you even want them now, I can pass you out some. But there was a time a few months ago that I think I passed that out on a Sunday morning during class time, maybe. Remember that? I did that, didn't I? Okay. So you've got that. Some of you may even have it in your Bible cases. Anyway, he uses the same year that I'm going to use for this. And it will involve the French Revolution at the other end. But first of all, we go to 533 A.D. That's the very year that Brother Brumback used on his chart. And if you have that chart, you remember that he talked there about John II being declared to be the Lord of the Church, the Universal Father. I think maybe I mentioned last time that at first, the popes were not over anything but their own city and area. There was a pope of Jerusalem. There was a pope of Rome. There was a pope of Alexandria. There was a pope of Constantinople. There were popes in many of these major towns. And they vied for supremacy, and the pope of Rome accumulated power till he became renowned as the Universal Father by Justinian, the Eastern Emperor. Remember, Constantine, in 330 A.D., changed the capital of the Roman Empire from Rome over to Constantinople, Byzantium, which he renamed Constantinople after himself. Today, the same city is known as Istanbul, but it's still the same city in the same place. At any rate, by 476 A.D., the last emperor of the Roman Empire in the West was gone, Romulus Augustulus. He was emperor for less than a year, and then you had the rest of the barbarian invasion, which already had been gaining speed, but the barbarians just came in, and in 476 A.D., Odoacer, the barbarian, was the first barbarian king of Rome. So you didn't have emperors in Rome anymore. Meanwhile, they went on in Constantinople, which, after all, was the capital of the empire. Justinian was the capital of the Eastern Empire. He was the one with the authority to make statements like this, and he said that John II of Rome is the Lord of the Church. He's over all the churches, and that's the first time, to my knowledge, that this had been said. So it was Justinian who declared Pope John II to be the first pope in the sense of universality. Now, when you look in that book I just showed you, they'll have them all from the Apostle Peter's number one, and you go on up from that. But it will even say that they hadn't accumulated power yet to be universal, up until when you get to 533, then they're universal. To me, that's the point at which the man of sin was revealed, as predicted by Paul in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. The man of sin shall be revealed, says Paul, and I think that's the point at which that came to light. Ah, this is the one. This is the one. This is the guy. And then 1,260 years from that, we come to the time of the French Revolution in 1793, because it was the French Revolution which broke the back of the papacy as nothing else could have. And the most critical, the French Revolution actually started in 1789 with the storming of the Bastille. But the most critical period of the French Revolution is the French Convention from late 1792 until 1795. Started in 1792. But the French Revolution is largely traceable to the corruption of the papal religion. It just got so bad. You didn't have any reformation in France because they had Louis XIV, who reigned for 73 years, was called the Sun King, and was very, very Catholic. He wouldn't let there be any reformation. You got Huguenots, kick them out of the country, let them go somewhere else after we kill some of them. And some of them, eventually, the descendants of those Huguenots wound up here in the United States and can still trace their lineage to the Huguenots that were expelled from France. But 1793 was a pivotal, if not the pivotal, date in the French Revolution. With the radicals of the French Convention, they just blew the lid off of France. As we said a moment ago, in response to one of Ed's comments, they didn't want to just do away with Roman Catholicism, but with all gods, whether big G God or a little G God, they wanted rid of all gods. They wanted a complete new world order with a completely natural approach to life. In other words, just deal with things as we see them on this earth, plants and animals and so forth. They even changed the names of the months because the months were named after the Greek and Roman gods and goddesses. So they didn't want that anymore. That's too religious. Change the name of the months. And as Ed said, they started time again. Or I don't think he said this, but they did start time again. They did away with the so-called year of our Lord and just started with the year one. And that was adopted in 1793. As Ed said, they did away with the week because that comes from Genesis 1. They had 10-day periods known as decades for a while. Bottom line on this was the most calculated and determined attack on God and the Bible by a collective unit of people in the history of the world, with the possible exception now of some of the communist nations that we have had. But up until that time, it was by far the most calculated and determined attack on God and the Bible by a governmental unit in the history of the world. 1793 was the year they chopped off the heads of King Louis XVI and Marie Antoinette, his wife. He on January the 21st and she on October the 16th. It was when this all started late in 1792, September 20th, 1792, that the poet and literary man Goethe said, "Here and now begins a new epoch in world history." And they really believed that. They thought they were starting something new, similar to the way Hitler thought he was starting a Reich that would last 1,000 years. They thought that what they were starting would be the new way. This would point the way for all the other nations of the earth. It was a revolution that would just sweep the globe and everybody would join in after that. 1793 was the first full year of that. Notre Dame Cathedral, which has been in the news recently because it burned a while back, and now they have refurbished it, so you may have seen it on your television screen, Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris, stopped being Notre Dame Cathedral and became the Temple of Reason, because you can't have anything religious. Christian funeral services were abolished. Cemeteries had to display the inscription, "Death is an eternal sleep." And the French nation declared itself to be atheistic. This is why the papal power received a shock from which it never recovered, and I believe never really can recover. The Roman Catholic Church had its sources of revenue completely undermined. It lost control of its diocese. Its property was confiscated. You could say what goes around comes around, because they had persecuted people for a long time, and now that persecution was purposefully copied all too faithfully by a generation of people who were completely ignorant, even of the first elements of the Christian faith, as we read about it in the Bible. Priests were shot. They were drowned. They were roasted. In 5 years, 2 million people were killed, including 24,000 priests. 40,000 church buildings were turned into stables for horses. And all those buildings were stripped of their valuable metals. Each day of the year was designated by a separate title of its own. And these names, since they wanted to go back to nature, these names were taken generally from agriculture and from domesticated animals, so that you had the day of the apple, the day of the olive, the day of the horse, the day of the ox. But when they came to name December 25th, they named it the day of the dog, as a personal insult to Jesus Christ, who in Roman Catholic tradition was supposed to have been born on that day. All the monuments of monarchy were destroyed. The tombs of the kings were violated. The Bishop of Paris was prevailed upon to publicly abjure the Christian faith and say that it was all malarkey. A naked prostitute was worshipped as the goddess of reason with accompanying orgies. All the members of the French Convention lived publicly with mistresses, because to have done otherwise would have been to expose them to the suspicion of being Christians. You're familiar with the idea of cancel culture in our time. In this time in Paris and French nation generally, the Christians were canceled, or those whom they deemed to be Christians, followers of this. That there was no dissent allowed, so it was just the people from Roman Catholicism. But they were being canceled. During these years, half the births in Paris were illegitimate. And we haven't even talked about the Reign of Terror in 1794, the next year, when the revolution really ate its own. After you've killed all the nobles and you start in on the shopkeepers, you know, you've got daily executions in the capital in Paris and a lot of extermination out in the provinces of France as well. The moderates perished because they were inferior in wickedness to the extremists who were their opponents. What we're talking about is a time in France when men were given over to their own reprobate minds. Hundreds and at last thousands were executed daily in the capital. And the people that had done the most of this and advocated it also got their heads cut off eventually, because you can always find something on somebody. Somebody said, show me the man, I'll show you the crime. You want to kill somebody and there's no real law, it's just your word, you get in power and you can cut off basically whatever heads you want to cut off. This can only go on for so long, of course. And finally, in 1799, the French Directory was overturned by a coup d'etat, and a government then was established with Napoleon as first consul. There were two other consuls, but neither one of them had the right to restrain him by their votes. So Napoleon is basically in charge from 1799 on, and he's just the type of guy that's going to continue to accumulate all the power that he can. The power of the people was totally abrogated by a government which swept away every remnant of freedom. When Napoleon took over, this is one of the signposts in history where you could say that the Pope's temporal reign was declared to be at an end. It got even worse later, but even at this early date, you could say that the Pope's temporal reign really had come to an end. Excuse me, didn't know if I was going to or not, but it's going to come. Needs to get out of there so we can go on. Napoleon was an extremely capable man, as I think you know. He had no god but ambition. Napoleon was just as comfortable using the Pope as abusing the Pope, whichever suited his political purposes the best. In 1798, Pope Pius VI was over 80 years of age. He was ordered by Napoleon to dispossess himself of all temporal authority. And refusing to do that, on February 15th of that year, this aged pope, while he was seated on his throne, was arrested. He was forcibly removed from his throne since he wouldn't leave voluntarily. He was dragged from the altar in his palace. Everything was ransacked and plundered. The pope's ring that he wore constantly, which signified his position as the husband of the church. Of course, that's really Christ's position, but he takes the place of Christ. He's the husband of the church, and he's got a ring to prove it. That was just torn right off his finger. And he was carried off as a prisoner and died in exile at the age of 82 in Tuscany in August of 1799. The Vatican was stripped down to its bare walls, all the precious metals removed. Territorial possessions of the Roman Church and its monasteries were confiscated and declared to be the national property of France. Remember the context of this. I think just last week, we talked about the time of Charlemagne back in 1,000 years earlier. At that time, in Charlemagne's time, power had been invested in the emperor of the Holy Roman Empire. Charlemagne had been crowned by the Pope, as I told you, on December 25th, 800 AD. And every Holy Roman emperor since that time had been crowned by the Pope. But Napoleon, rather than going to Rome for his coronation as emperor of the French, just as Charlemagne had done and all the emperors of the West since Charlemagne's time, Napoleon instead summoned the old sick pope, and this is Pius VII, the next pope, to make a journey of 1,000 miles to Paris to crown Napoleon as the Emperor of the French. No pope had ever been summarily summoned in this way. That was an insult in itself. Napoleon met the pope at the gate of the city of Paris. Napoleon did not kneel before the pope. Napoleon did not try to receive a blessing from the pope. Napoleon did not kiss the pope's hand, all the stuff that he was supposed to do. And at Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris on December the 2nd, 1804, at the coronation ceremony, everything was set in place. Napoleon is trying to look like he's following tradition. The museum director has produced a colorful imitation of Charlemagne's scepter. Napoleon was robed in an ancient antique imperial mantle. He's surrounded by cardinals. The pope is there, seated and waiting to crown Napoleon. And when the appointment instant came, at the moment of the crowning, everybody was expecting Napoleon, who had never bowed the knee to anybody, to kneel before the so-called Holy Father. When the pope said, "Receive the imperial crown," instead of kneeling, Napoleon unexpectedly turned. He snatched the crown out of the hands of the pope, turned his back on the pope and the altar, and then Napoleon crowned himself in the sight of all France in Notre Dame Cathedral, holding that crown over his own head. This was a symbolic hour. Napoleon had reduced to mockery the supposedly legitimate formalities that he was affecting to copy and carry out. And the crowd in Notre Dame gasped because the symbolism was clear to all and all too clear. Napoleon, everybody in the room knew, and it's a big room, that Napoleon had made a laughingstock of the pope. Napoleon is saying, in essence, the pope is not what he used to be. And that was true. Napoleon was saying, in essence, I have the pope here to make the point that I don't need the pope to make me emperor. Napoleon actually imprisoned two popes. And for the next several decades, the authority of the papal system progressively deteriorated. In 1848, Pope Pius IX had to flee Rome again, being driven away. And this culminated, long story short, the bottom line is, in the period of time from 1866 to 1870, the complete loss of the pope's temporal power. And Victor Emmanuel was declared to be the king of Italy, and the pope, he'd lost his temporal power. The papal states are gone, everything's gone, and he's back down to the 110 acres of Vatican City, which today has a population of 840. And in our own time, we're seeing this continuing deterioration with the scandals springing up from the priest's sexual abuse of children and the millions and millions of dollars that have been paid out to the families of these abused children and all the cover-ups involved. The Roman Church continues to take hit after hit. I don't think you can point to any place on earth today where the pope is persecuting religious dissenters because he simply does not have the power to do it. He's lost that power. I think I told you last week, if the pope were to regain power again, he would never tolerate you. He'd never tolerate people like me because he doesn't want any dissent. But he just doesn't have the power. So the bottom line here is there is no entity in history that so well fits the description of the little horn in Daniel 7 as the papal dynasty of the Roman Catholic Church. It was Isaac Newton who said that for every action there is an equal and opposite reaction. Reaction to the excesses of the great apostasy and the revelations of its corruption, I believe, was directly responsible for bringing about things like the Second Great Awakening, where we had a whole bunch of back-to-the-Bible movements right at this same time that we've been talking about. Whole bunch of back-to-the-Bible movements in many countries and in many languages. Just in our own English-speaking world, we had James O'Kelly and Abner Jones and Elias Smith, Barton W. Stone, the Cane Ridge, Kentucky Revival, Thomas and Alexander Campbell. All of these back-to-the-Bible movements. And the Lord's Church then became recognized as the largest indigenous religious movement in the United States. Last week, once we encountered the little horn here in verse 8, we just went ahead, as I've said, and accumulated other information in this chapter to get a fuller picture of the little horn. So now we need to go back to verse 9. But before that, I'll pause and see if you have anything else to ask or say about the little horn. This is a natural dividing place. Okay, let's go ahead, and you can always go back to some of these things if you want to. Let's go back, and I'll just read verse 9. I beheld till the thrones were cast down, and the Ancient of Days did sit, whose garment was white as snow, and the hair of his head was like the pure wool, and his throne was like the fiery flame, and his wheels as burning fire. I think what's happened here is that, and believe me, even though we're only in verse 9, we're really almost done with the chapter because we've looked ahead at it so much to get a fuller picture of the little horn. But there's a little bit to say here about a few verses. The development of the little horn was so momentous, and there's so much in the Bible about it, and it had such a tremendous impact on the people of God over time, that at this point in the vision, after he's told us a little bit about the little horn, the scene in the vision switches from earth to heaven. John continued looking, and he saw suddenly thrones that were set in place, and this they were set there for judgment. This is the heavenly court, and we see several descriptions of it in the Bible. We see it in Ezekiel chapter 1. We see it in Isaiah chapter 6. We see it in Revelation chapter 4. It's basically the same scene that all of these prophets see, the heavenly court, and it's set in orderly procession for the divine judgment against the fourth beast which grew the little horn. It's interesting here we find the only representation of God the Father in human form in the Bible. He's called the Ancient of Days. The only place he's called the Ancient of Days is in this chapter in verses 9, 12, and 22. Only time that God the Father is called the Ancient of Days. So here we have a heavenly throne scene, much like those in Isaiah 6, Ezekiel 1, and Revelation 4. And those are over time. Ezekiel would be about 700 years before Christ. Isaiah would be about 700 years before Christ. Ezekiel 600 years before Christ. John writing Revelation 100 years after Christ. But they all see this same scene in heaven. Things evidently don't change too much up there. In the chariot throne scene that's described in Ezekiel chapter 1, there were fire and wheels. So often, many, many times in the Bible, God is said to be enthroned above the cherubim. The cherubim are one of the highest orders of creation, if not the highest order of creation. They combine the characteristics of the rest of the living beings that God has created on earth. So they have like four faces, and they indicate not only the idea that it has some of the characteristics of humanity, but also characteristics of the animal kingdom, characteristics of the angelic world as well. So we don't know much about them. I would describe the cherubim as well as the seraphim as forms of angelic life. But God is said to be enthroned above the cherubim. We are told that God is a consuming fire. He comes in flaming fire, taking vengeance, 2 Thessalonians 1. His angels execute his judgment, and they are called a flaming fire, Hebrews chapter 1. I'll read a little bit more here. Verse 10, a fiery stream issued and came forth from before him. Thousand thousands ministered unto him, and 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. The judgment was set, and the books were opened. I beheld then, because of the voice of the great words which the horn spake, I beheld even till the beast was slain, and his body destroyed, and given to the burning flame. This is talking about the end of that institution, which is eventually going to come. From the standpoint that Daniel is talking about here. The judgment was set, the books were opened, containing all the deeds of the fourth beast with its little horn. So this is the judgment of Rome. And it's described, of course, in apocalyptic language, but bear in mind, this is the judgment of an institution. This is not the final judgment of individuals. That comes later. But this is the judgment of an institution. The temporal papal empire is ended as a beast. Daniel saw a fourth beast. And later on, when this is more fully developed in Revelation chapter 13, John there sees two beasts. But he's talking about the same thing. Just as when astronomers make telescopes And when they started making telescopes, they weren't very powerful, so they sometimes would see something that looked like a single star way out there in the sky. And then later, when we made more powerful telescopes, we could see that what we thought was a single star really was what we now call a binary star. It's two stars circling each other, and at a distance with a poor telescope, it looks like one star. Maybe with the human eye, it looks like one star. But when we can see it more clearly through a good telescope, it's a binary star, two stars circling each other. I think that's what happened here. Writing 700 years later than Daniel, the Apostle John was given a more powerful prophetic telescope that showed more detail. So Daniel speaks of one beast here. The Apostle John speaks of two, but we're talking still about the same thing. And remember, in Revelation chapter 19, verse 20, the beast and the false prophet there are cast into the lake of fire. Even though we don't have the final judgments of individual until the end of chapter 20, at the great white throne judgment scene, I saw a great white throne and him that sat on it from whose faith the earth and the heaven fled away. That's the same final judgment that Jesus talked about in the 25th chapter of the book of Matthew with the sheep on the right hand and the goats on the left. But here we're talking about the end of an institution, the end of the temporal power of an institution. I always see a glare on that. I guess it's time for me to stop. That's kind of an unfortunate place to stop, but I want you to come back next week so I don't dare take us over time. Thank you very much. And once again, I didn't leave time for questions at the end, but if you have them, hold them for next time or ask me later on tonight. Bill, I guess it's time for the announcements.